This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We are now heading into the meat of the barbecue season. And for all of you backyard pitmasters, what is your go-to cut? Maybe a nicely marbled brisket? If you're going to get fancy, maybe a nice porterhouse, or the classic couple of burgers. What about chicken? Chicken can be tricky. I understand. It takes constant surveillance. My next guest is here to break down the science behind barbecue chicken, and he's going to answer your science grilling questions. Meathead Goldwyn runs the Amazing Ribs website. He joins us from WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome back to the program.
It's a pleasure to be back, Ira. It's always good talking to you.
You know, my mouth just starts watering when we start listening to you talk.
I have a dirty job.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Let me allow our listeners to get in. Our number is 844-724-8255, and you can also tweet us at SciFry. That number again, 844-724-SciTalk. Let's talk about this beer can chicken. It's one of the most popular ways to barbecue a chicken. You've done your own research on the method. How good is it?
Well, first of all, beer can chicken is a roast chicken, and there's nothing wrong with roast chicken. Everybody loves roast chicken. But a lot of people seem to think that there's something magical that happens when you stick a beer can up the butt of a chicken, and it just doesn't happen. That beer can is like a giant condom. The beer can't escape it. It can't get through the can into the walls of the meat, and there's so very little space at the top of the can. And what's even funnier is as the chicken cooks, the fat and the juices drip into the beer can, and it gets a layer of fat on top. But the most important concept of all is that the chicken comes out of the refrigerator at 38 degrees, and it's a cold, wet blanket wrapped around the beer can. So it's just like a chicken beer koozie. Your beer can is never going to get any hotter than the chicken. And if you cook the chicken properly, you cook it to safe temperature, 160, 165 degrees, that beer is never getting over 150, 160. It's just not going to boil.
Is there any way to do the beer better? I mean, instead of in the can, is it a worthy thing to try? Not the beer can chicken, but to add beer to your recipe.
Well, you could drink the beer and then take a bite of the chicken and take a drink of the beer and a bite of the chicken. Standing a chicken on its end makes a lot of sense because you do get convection airflow if you leave the cavity empty. And then the chicken heats from the inside out. You know, a lot of people don't understand that when you cook meat, whether it's indoors or outdoors or vegetables, it's the hot air that cooks the outside of the food. But the outside of the food is what cooks the inside of the food. The outside of the food is like a battery. It stores the energy and pushes it down into the center. The air doesn't get into the center of the meat. It's the energy from the hot air stored in the exterior of the meat that cooks the interior of the meat. So if you empty the cavity, then you have the ability to get hot air inside the meat. You cook it from both sides, and there's less drying out of the meat.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I grill chicken and I grill chicken parts, and I'm always wondering, I know that there's a bone in some of the parts of the chicken. I know that the bone conducts heat, and maybe it will cook that part of the chicken near the bone faster. Should I flip it over on the not bone side, or do I want to cook the bone side first, or just put it all under the hood and leave it there?
Yeah. You know, actually, it's interesting. The bone is also an insulator. It just heats at a different rate than the meat. Meat is about 75% water. The bone is a little less water. It's a drier compound. So at first, it's actually a insulator, and then as it warms up, it becomes a conductor. So it really changes its properties as you're cooking. The secret to good chicken is, and the secret to all good grilling, is set up your grill in two zones. One side is hot, the other side is not. Indirect convection heat on one side, direct radiant heat on the other side, and you start your food on the indirect side where it's not as hot. Gently warm it. You lose less moisture that way. It evenly cooks throughout. And then, just the opposite of everything you've been told, you sear it at the end of the cook, and then you put all that energy on the surface, you crisp the surface, you brown the surface, and you take it off hot and crispy. Mm. And you don't have flare-ups that way either.
Oh, yeah.
You cook indirect.
Oh, yeah.
Chicken is notorious for...
Forest fire in the grill.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
go ahead.
Oh, I mean, you just should carbonize you
use a,
your
should,
chicken.
Should you use a water bottle? You know, should you be ready if that happens and try to spray?
If you're using charcoal and it starts really flaring up, a water bottle will help. But you should not have flare-ups. If you use two zones, start on the indirect, and right. you cook by convection airflow that gently warms it, and you can throw some wood chunks on the charcoal, and that'll put smoke in the air. You'll never have a flare-up.
Hmm. Here's a tweet from Annette who says, to brine or not to brine first?
Ah, salt is magical. Salt is different than any other spice and herb in the cabinet. It's a very small molecule, sodium chloride, and it splits when it gets wet. It gets electrical charges, and salt really penetrates deep into the center of the meat. Garlic's just not getting past the surface. Too big a molecule. Sugar, black pepper, but salt gets down in there. And so brining is a great technique because salt helps retain moisture, and it also adds flavor. It's an amplifier. It builds flavor. Now, there's two ways to go about brining. One is to get a big bucket of water and put salt in it and dunk it in there. But there's a really easier technique, and it works just as well, and that's what we call dry brining. And that is an hour or two before you cook, sprinkle your meat with salt. What happens is the salt melts, and it moves into the chicken or the steak or whatever you're cooking. It migrates down into the food, and it does its little job of moisturizing and flavor building that way. And you don't need to get a big bucket and fill it with water and measure out the percentage of, rule of thumb, about a half a teaspoon of kosher salt per pound of meat.
I want to bring on somebody you might enjoy our next little segment. We're going to talk about chimps and cooking. And my next guest says that humans may not be the only ones who enjoy a nice cooked meal. It appears that chimps also like a cooked potato or two. They can't control fire to barbecue their meat or their bananas or whatever they have, but they do have the cognitive ability to prefer cooked meals over raw ones. And my next guest and her colleagues tested out this question, and the results are published in the journal Proceedings of the Royal Society B. Alexandra Rosati is an evolutionary biologist at Harvard University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How do we know that chimps really like to eat cooked food? What did your experiment show?
Well, actually, we did a whole set of experiments looking at a lot of different capacities for cooking. So, you know, the obvious thing that you think of when you think of cooking is controlling fire. But we were thinking about it that actually cooking involves a lot of really complex cognitive capacities. So at one end, you have things like preferring cooked food, because if you don't even like cooked food, why would you do this in the first place? But you also need things like patience, because cooking takes time, and self-control, because you have access to raw food when you start cooking, but you have to refrain from eating it in order to acquire the cooked food. So we did a series of experimental studies with chimps where we gave them the opportunity to place raw food in their own possession in a sort of magical artificial device that transformed it into cooked food.
And they preferred from what I understand from this test, when given the choice, they would actually wait for you to cook them the food, then take the raw food that's sitting there right in front of them.
Yeah, so we found that, you know, at the most basic level, they had a strong preference for, in our test, cooked potatoes over raw potatoes. And some previous research had already found that chimps preferred a variety of foods better when cooked, so things like meat and other tubers like potatoes and carrots. And so we tried to take it a couple of steps further. So, for example, we looked at whether they were willing to wait delays while food was being cooked, and also whether they would transport food, because you think often when humans are cooking, you find the raw food at one location, you know, in modern life at the grocery store, yeah. But in traditional societies when you're foraging, then you have to transport it, which is sort of an inhibitory control problem because you could be snacking on it the whole time. And we found that in a variety of situations, chimps were willing to pay these costs in order to acquire the cooked food.
So they would bring the raw food across the room to you to so-called cook it for them.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it was a challenging problem for them because, you know, chimps are knuckle walkers. walkers. So they would very often try to carry the food actually in their mouth. And he would see them almost eat it on accident, right? You can imagine trying to carry some raw cookie dough in your mouth if you were walking over to your oven. You might take a bite now and then. And they definitely had problems completing these tasks, but they were able to do so at a pretty high rate.
Is there any evidence that, I should ask Jane Goodall this question or someone else, that chimps ever had cooked meals or cooked food out in, you know, the wild where maybe there was a fire that happened? They discovered
it? Well, in wild chimps, there are some observations of wild chimps observing natural fires and even entering forests where bushfires have gone through and trying to eat some of the seeds or nuts that are left behind, suggesting that, you know, chimps can sort of calmly watch fires without totally freaking out, and they also seem to make some potential inferences about the utility of fire. And I think our studies add to that by really disentangling the exact cognitive processes that they're using to do these behaviors.
Now, we had primatologist Richard Wrangham on, and he said that cooking had an effect on our evolution. Does this sort of tie in with that?
Yeah, actually, Richard Wrangham's cooking hypothesis was sort of the original inspiration for our studies, because Richard Wrangham proposed that cooking was this really fundamental shift in human evolution that occurred fairly early, earlier than other people necessarily agree that cooking sort of emerged. And we were thinking that actually these sorts of psychological tests with chimpanzees can provide another line of insight into this question. Because if chimpanzees are able to make these inferences, that's pretty good evidence that the last common ancestor of humans and other apes also could make these kinds of inferences.
Meathead Goldwyn, any reaction to all of this?
Well, I could be potato head myself. I eat potatoes in all forms. And I've read Richard Wrangham's book, and it's brilliant in my mind. I just have to wonder if they were offered a banana at one or the other end of the process, if they're just not trading one food for another, and if they're cognizant of this raw potato being a different form of the cooked potato. Do they see that as the both being potato?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And actually, we had a couple of studies in our set of experiments trying to really look at exactly what you're saying. Like, do they just think that they're trading something for something better? And actually, what we found is that the chimps specifically tried to place raw food in these devices. So if we gave them food that had been pre-cooked, so you didn't need to place it in the device, then they refrained from doing so. And also, if we gave them inedible items, you might imagine that they think, oh, I could just put this piece of wood in the device and I'll get something tasty out of it. But we found that actually they were quite uninterested in trying to place inedible items in the device. So we think this suggests they have, you know, some basic comprehension of how this transformation is happening.
All right. Fascinating, Dr. Rosati. Thank you for taking the time to be with us today. Good luck in your further research.
Thank you.
Alexander Rosati is an evolutionary biologist at Harvard University. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Meathead Goldwyn, who is from Amazing Ribs, AmazingRibs.com. We're talking about barbecuing and how to become a better chef on the grill out there. And we're focusing on chicken, but we're willing to talk about other stuff on the grill. What is your favorite thing to grill, Meathead? Or is that a silly question?
No. I think... I really love a good lamb chop. I really love a good thick lamb chop. I guess red meat is, but come August, I will go a week or longer without touching meat. I mean, the garden is in full bloom. I just cooked the other night eggplant parmesan by making a marinara sauce by grilling tomatoes, carrots, celery, onion, and garlic, putting them through the food processor. Unbelievable marinara sauce. Put the eggplant on the grill, spoon the marinara sauce on top, grated parmesan on top of that, and a little bit of mozzarella. Oh, my goodness. So, you know, summertime's here. Doesn't have to be meat every night.
Yeah, I'm partial to portobello mushrooms on the grill.
Oh, yeah. And I think if I lived on the coast, I'd be fish head.
Meathead. I want to let's talk about pink meat not always being raw. Where does the pink color come from?
Well, particularly with pink color comes from myoglobin. Myoglobin is a mixture of water and protein. A lot of people think when they cut into a steak, that juice that runs out is blood. But it's not blood. It's this myoglobin fluid. Blood would be very dark red, almost black, just like yours when you cut, and it would coagulate instantly. So, I mean, I like to say every time we call it blood, somehow a teenager becomes a vegan. We're just grossing people out. And that's why I think so many people want their food cooked to well done. They don't want to see the blood. But it's not blood. It's just myoglobin. And there's a big issue with chicken on this subject. You know, we grow chickens now so fast. They come to market in 6 to 8 weeks. The bones don't have a chance to calcify. The way we process them and handle them, you can cook it up to 165. And by the way, I'm going to jump off for a second here. The most important tool an indoor cook or an outdoor cook can own is a good digital thermometer. Meat is ready when the thermometer says so, not when the clock says so. 165 degrees is safe for chicken. Consumer Reports did some tests in their February issue. 97% of 300 chicken breasts they tested had pathogenic bacteria in it. And half of those were antibiotic resistant. At 160 to 165 degrees, it's safe. Spend $25, get a digital thermometer, not an old-fashioned dial thermometer. They're not as accurate. And medium-rare steak is 130 degrees. You'll never overcook and waste money. You'll never undercook and get anybody sick.
Good. And about washing the chicken, what's the mythology of that?
Yeah, there's some really good research on that, too. If you wash chicken, you put a spray in the air, invisible spray in the air. So you're standing there at your sink with your dish drain next to you and all your clean dishes there. And actually, you can be spraying microbes up in the air as you wash it. The scientists say, don't wash your chicken. I know it sounds weird and it may feel a little slimy, but as soon as the chicken hits the heat, anything that's on there is dead.
Yeah.
So they say, don't wash it. Otherwise, you'll get pathogens all over your kitchen counter and all over your dish drain.
Yeah, all right. We're going to have to take a break, and we're going to take a break and come back and talk more about cooking, grilling outdoors, chicken, other stuff we'll tackle. Our number, 844-724-8255. Talking with Meathead Goldwyn from AmazingRibs.com. Great website. It's the science of grilling this hour. You can also tweet us at SciFry. The number again, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. I'm just getting hungry talking about it. We'll be back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the science of barbecue and grilling. My guest is Meathead Goldwyn from AmazingRibs.com. Our number, 844-724-8255. There are a lot of folks who would like to talk to you, so let's go right to the phones. Let's go to Ted. Somebody's off the line there. Let's try this one. Let's go to David in Huntsville, North Carolina. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
Hi there.
I had a question about beer can chicken. Is when you cook that, is the steam from the liquid what causes the chicken to be so tender, or does the alcohol from the beer actually have something to do with that?
Well, as I think I answered earlier, there is not much steam from the beer. It can't get hotter than the chicken, which is surrounding it. And boiling is around 190 to 200, 212. It starts to steam at 190, 200. It boils at 212. The chicken's done at 165. It does not steam. If you weigh the can before and after, in many cases, the can weighs more after because the fat drips into the can and the fat lays on top of the beer, so it doesn't work. It doesn't steam. Hmm. It doesn't get into the meat. And even if it did steam, where would the steam go? The can is in the way. It can't go through the can.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe someone just tuning in at that point.
Well, we did the first 10 minutes in about 30 seconds.
You got it all in there. Let's go. Tucson, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi there.
I used to have a recipe from James Beard that called for boiling spare ribs in water with celery and carrots, you know, make a broth and boil it in there with spices for about 10 minutes, 15 minutes. and then letting it sit in a marinade of wine and barbecue sauce, and then grilling it, and it always turned out great. But it's just tender and juicy, and I can't find that recipe. I looked for it on the internet. Maybe can you shed some light on that for me?
Well, James Beard wrote one of the very first books on grilling and barbecue, and I have it. So if you'll come to the website and drop me a note, I'll find you that recipe if it's in the book that I have. But just a thought for you about that subject. Water is a solvent. Water dissolves things. That's why you use it on your windshields. That's why you wash your hands with it. When you put meat in water, what happens? The water turns brown. You're making rib stew, rib juice, rib soup. So you're pulling flavor out of the meat. It makes a very flavorful meat, but you know, a low and slow dry cooking method, you're going to have more pork flavor. That's why a lot of the great barbecue restaurants in the world, or roadside barbecue stands, they use a smoker and they keep the temperature down around 225. They put a great spice rub on the surface and then they hit it with a little barbecue sauce at the end, and all that flavor stays in the meat.
Mm. There's a phenomenon called the meat stall, right? It can be your brisket's worst nightmare. What is happening there? Describe what it is and what's happening.
Yeah, this is something that happens only to people who are deep into barbecue when they're making a long, low, and slow cook of a big slug of meat like a pork shoulder or a ham or a beef brisket. These are big chunks of meat. And you cook them at a low temperature because they have a lot of connective tissue. And if you cook them at a low temperature for a long time, well past well done, like up to 200 degrees in the meat, it melts those connective tissues and you get this succulent, gelatinous texture that only happens in low and slow cooking. But what happens at that low temperature is moisture starts evaporating from the surface. And as it evaporates, it cools the meat. So you get this point, and especially newbies who are just getting started with smoking, where the meat hits a temperature around 150, 160, and it doesn't go up. And it sits there for hours, and they panic, and they send me emails. They find my phone number, and they go, what am I going to do? It's called the stall. It's an equilibrium where the meat is cooling by evaporation, and yet it's warming from the warm air, and you just got to ride it out. And what happens eventually is the surface dries out, and that's what makes the crust or the bark that we all love, the crunchy, concentrated flavor where your rub was. And so you just got to ride it out. You can beat the stall by wrapping the meat in aluminum foil, but a lot of us just have patience.
It'll overcome itself. You just leave it.
Eventually, as the surface dries out, it stops evaporating water and it stops cooling, and the meat just starts chugging right on through and finishes cooking.
We've had a couple of callers calling in. I got three or four, so I'll just say it myself. What about cooking vegetables? I know your name is Meathead, but do you have any tips for grilling veggies?
I love grilling veggies, and I was talking earlier about how I made eggplant parmesan just the other day. The big difference between veggies and meat is veggies have a little higher water content. They run about 90%, let's say. Meat runs about 75%. That's shocking to a lot of people. Meat is 75% water. Vegetables, 80, 90% are water. Whereas meat has protein and fat, vegetables have more sugar and carbohydrates. But pretty much salt and pepper and some herbs are all you need. The same basic core concept. Two zones, a hot side and a not hot side. That way you can gently cook the food in the not hot side. And then when you want to get browning, which is a chemical reaction called the Maillard reaction or caramelization, which is when sugar changes, you can move it over to the hot side and get those browning flavors. And so you can control your temperature moving back and forth from the not so hot to the hot side. And, oh goodness, start with corn on the cob, everybody's favorite, zucchini, eggplant parm, as I said, roasted peppers, stuffed peppers. August around our house is cooking off the garden time.
Mm-hmm. So there's no need to put the stuff in your oven first and then finish it. on the grill.
No, a grill is an oven. Mm-hmm. It's just a different kind of oven. The worst, the biggest difference between a grill and your oven is the thermometer on your grill. It's a piece of garbage. I don't care how much you spent for it. And it's up there in the dome, and your food is down there on the grate. So it's telling you what the temperature of the dome is, which does you no good unless you plan to eat the dome. You want a temperature of the meat. Again, thermometers. Forgive me for preaching thermometers.
No, no, no. We're science. We measure things. We understand that.
Measure things, exactly. Yeah.
So where should you put the thermometer? Should you get a stand-up one that sits on the grill itself?
The best thermometers are these new digital. This is 2015, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
Let me look.
We got the 2015. We got digital thermometers. You can get a probe, and you can lay it right next to the meat, so the probe is feeling exactly what the meat is feeling. Now, you don't want it too close to the meat because there's a cold air bubble around the meat. You want it a couple of inches away from the meat, but right at the level on the cooking surface. You can also put a probe into the meat and watch the meat as it cooks. And then, of course, the best thing is the instant read thermometer. $25 for a thermometer that gives you a reading in 5 seconds, $100 for one that gives you a reading in 2 seconds, and you can stick it anywhere in the meat and know exactly what the temperature is, and there's no guesswork.
And you would say that's the most important thing to know about grilling is getting that thermometer.
Yes.
If you had one tip to give to somebody...
Get a good digital thermometer.
Good digital thermometer. What about that?
I bought $10,000 worth of thermometers last year and gave them to an electrical engineer and bought some equipment for him to bench test them. And we have all that test results on the website.
Let's get to one last call from Alicia in Pennsylvania. Hi.
Hi. First of all, I promise I will buy a thermometer that is digital. I promise.
I love you, Alicia.
Second of all... How do you clean the grill? I have a gas grill, and it has these two, the grill tops where you cook the meat. The instruction said that I should just, put the heat high for 5 minutes after I'm done cooking, and then that's clean. But all the ashes stay on the grill. Do I clean those ashes? Do I leave them? What do I do?
That's carbonized meat protein and fat that sits on there, or in the case of vegetables, carbohydrates and other things. And they just carbonize. They burn. So you need to get a brush. You can actually take a handful of wadded up aluminum foil and just scrape it across there, and it works pretty well. But it doesn't get underneath, and that's where grease builds up, and you want to get the grease off. So the best thing is to get a brush, and you want one that's very sturdy where the bristles are stuck in there really well. Cheap brushes, the bristles can fall out, and every year we read these cases of people who ate a hamburger, swallowed a brass bristle from a grill brush, and had to be rushed to the hospital. Not a great way to spend 4th of July.
Well.
So a wire brush or a wad of aluminum foil. There's a variety of cleaning devices. At the risk of promoting my website, we have ratings and reviews of all the cleaning devices. But yeah, fire it up, burn it to a carbonized black, and then scrape it down.
Well, Meathead, thank you for taking time to be here with us. Meathead Goldwyn.
Always fun.
AmazingRibs.com. What do you wish people? May all of your what be what? And when you say barbecuing to somebody, I don't know.
Cooking for others is an act of love. And the most important thing is not what's on the plate, but who's in the chairs.
And there you have it. Thank you. We could not have a better ending. Meathead Goldwyn from the website AmazingRibs.com. Have a great barbecuing weekend. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.